Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Reliance on personal transportation has shaped the places where we live and work and play. Now, concerns over the high price of oil, over pollution, and also sprawl have led a lot of people to question our commitment to the car. I suppose that's really not something that is really new. So here's the question we want to discuss here this morning. Is it possible that we can have both environmental sustainability and cars? Our guest for this show, someone who specializes in thinking about these kinds of issues, and we'll talk about transportation policy and whether that indeed can satisfy both the needs of the environment and also the kind of infrastructure needs that we're talking more and more about. And our guest for the program is Owen Goodfriend. He is Associate Professor of History and Urban Studies at Columbia University. And he's also director of the Barnard and Columbia Urban Studies programs. He's written widely on these subjects, and I do want to mention one book since it gets very specifically at some of the questions that we want to talk about here. And that is a book that's titled 20th Century Sprawl, Highways and the Reshaping of the American Landscape. That book was published by the Oxford University Press in 2004. Questions are certainly welcome. We'd like to get people involved in the conversation. And to do that, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, for all the local listeners, it's 333-9455. And if it would be long-distance call, if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana or any place else across the country, if you'd happen to be listening on the internet, use our toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions, comments brief so we can keep on moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. Professor Goodfriend, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to join you.
There are a number of things that I'd like to get into, and they're both distinct and also connected. Maybe just as a way of beginning, and this obviously is a very big question. Do you think that it is possible to address environmental quality questions and also some of our concerns about our dependence on oil and what's happening there with the price? Is it possible to get at both of those things through transportation planning and policy?
I think it's certainly possible. The one thing, though, that I must say is that we won't be able to combine those two things if we just keep doing what we've been doing, if we keep going the way we've been going. There are a lot of things we can be doing that will raise money for infrastructure improvements and the kind of infrastructure improvements that we need to be thinking about, and will also provide the right kinds of incentives for behavior that's environmentally sound and can put us on a better footing environmentally. Our current policies don't do that, but if we're willing to consider new approaches to some things, then we certainly can combine these two things.
Mm-hmm. And that, I suppose, gets at another issue, and that is even if we maybe have some significant reduction in the number of cars on the road, I don't think anybody expects them to go away. And if we're still even, and then if we move over and use more mass transit, we're still going to have roads, and they're still going to have to be maintained. And that's an issue that it seems that we haven't given the amount of attention to that we should, and more people are certainly saying that. As we do those other things, we're still going to have to come up with ways to make sure that our roads and bridges and rail systems and whatever else, the infrastructure that supports the transportation we use, does indeed get the attention that it deserves.
That's exactly right. We're not ever going to be able to change, and perhaps shouldn't, I don't know, that's a different question, but we're not going to be able to change to a carless society. We need to be able to get from here to there. The economy depends on it, and our lives depend on it, but we're doing it now in a way that is not sustainable environmentally, and even it's not sustainable if you set aside the environmental concerns. Our roads are crumbling, our bridges are collapsing, and the current financing mechanisms and transportation policies aren't adequately addressing those issues.
Mm. Well, just for a second to talk about the car. This is I know something that you're interested in. I don't know if that it's not necessarily a main focus, but it certainly is true that we have. I believe that it's true that we have more cars per capita now than, say, 50 years ago. More miles are being driven. And if we're concerned about that, about pollution generated, about congestion, we're also concerned about how it is we meet our energy needs. People are concerned about the cost of gasoline. Do you think that there seems to be little enthusiasm for this, but do you think that it makes sense for there to be mandated fuel economy standards?
Well, we've had mandated fuel economy standards as a corporate average for each car manufacturer since the first energy crisis of the 1970s. And then we got, as a country, we got kind of relaxed about it. There were great advances made in terms of the technology and the fuel economy profile of cars that Americans bought in the 70s and 80s when the car manufacturers were under fairly stiff mandates. And we allowed those mandates to relax. We didn't lower the standards, but we stopped raising them in the 1980s and 90s. And there's been, of course, resistance, corporate resistance, to raising them again recently, but we need to get past some of that corporate resistance because, as I said, we're not going to solve these problems if we keep going in the direction that we're going. And when you start talking about changing consumption patterns, changing driving patterns, changing consumer choices, those are economic changes. They don't have to be unprofitable changes, but they're going to change the directions in which the profits flow. What I specifically mean there is that the kinds of decisions, and none of these solutions are short-term solutions. If you think that Americans' lives are divided into four categories, there's where we live, where we work, where we play, and where we shop. For 50 years, we have subsidized our highways and subsidized driving, and what I mean by that is that the cost of the gas taxes, tolls, registration fees, all the costs that are passed on to users of the highways are less than half of the costs of actually providing that infrastructure. So this is a government service you can use without having to pay all the costs of it. And because of that subsidy, we've been allowing these four functions of our lives to get further and further away from each other, and we drive more and more every year. So it's not just, as you mentioned earlier, more cars per capita, but that each car is driven further because we live further from where we work, and those two things are further from where we shop, and those three things are further from where we play, and our lives are more spread out. That can't change in a day, a month, or a year, but over time, if we make the costs of driving more transparent to the driver and pass on more of those costs to the drivers, then people making choices about how they arrange their lives will take into account those costs more accurately.
This I want to get back to that, this idea of making the cost of driving more transparent so that people are more aware of them. But for a moment to talk a little bit about how it is we got to where we are, and this is in large part, I think, what the book 20th Century Sprawl is about. This seems to be a little bit of a chicken and egg question, if you'll forgive the cliche, how it is that we got where we are. Is this a growing infrastructure that made these kind of patterns of living and working and playing and shopping possible, or is it the other way around, that we were heading in that direction and that infrastructure had to be developed to serve that need?
Well, that's a very good question. The easiest way to understand this is to think that these policies were put into place a long time ago when very few Americans owned cars, but there were two important historical contexts to keep in mind. One is that at the turn of the century, urban infrastructure was far, far ahead of rural infrastructure. You had paved streets in particular in cities, whereas most of the United States outside of cities still had dirt roads and had no long-distance roads, no paved roads, no express routes. And so there's that one idea that cities were in better shape than rural areas at the time. And then also, cities were overcrowded in an unhealthy, uncomfortable, and unpleasant way. And you put those two things together, and what came out of it was a policy to build infrastructure in the rural areas and to direct funding collected in urban areas where the economic activity was happening and spend that money in rural areas. So the result was that we built the infrastructure initially in the rural areas as an equity concern to make it fairer to people who live outside of cities. But also we were trying to make it easier for people to move out of cities that were overcrowded and dysfunctional. Those were both really good objectives 100 years ago. We have continued those policies in place long past when they were needed for those same original reasons.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Owen Goodfriend. He is Associate Professor of History and Urban Studies at Columbia University. He's also Director of the Barnard and Columbia Urban Studies Programs. We're talking about transportation policy and what that has to do with dealing with addressing the needs of infrastructure and also its impact on the environment, and if it's possible to develop a kind of transportation policy that is actually good for the environment or less bad than what we're doing now. And that also provides some kind of a way to support the infrastructure that we all need and use. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana callers, if you want to join us. Toll-free 800-222-9455. To go back to the thing that you said before about how it is that we need to make the cost of driving more transparent. I think probably people, you start them thinking about, well, what are the cost of driving? The obvious things are the cost of buying a vehicle, maintaining it, and putting gas into it. That's sort of the immediate things you think about. But then, if you start thinking about it, well, if you're in a major metro area and you're driving on the roads there, maybe you're paying tolls. So there's another. And then if you really think about it, there are motor fuel taxes, state and federal taxes, that are supposed to go to maintaining the roads. So that's not maybe an obvious cost, but that's also a cost. And as I said, and that's supposed to go to try to maintain and address the needs of the infrastructure. Are there more costs than that? Are there more things that are actually there that have to be taken care of that people don't think of? Or is it the issue that those things that we think of, particularly motor fuel tax, doesn't really address the costs and doesn't really address the infrastructure needs?
Well, there are more costs, and there are some that are as, I don't want to say trivial, but some as straightforward as the State Departments of Motor Vehicles and the costs of making license plates and the costs of driver's licenses. In many, many cases, the fairly nominal charge that you pay for your registration of your car doesn't even cover the administrative overhead costs of the respective departments. Now, that varies by state to state. But really, the big cost that isn't covered by all those things that you just mentioned is the highways themselves. People, at this point, have gotten very much used to in the United States, if you buy your car and you put gas in it and you pay for your insurance, that you then are entitled to drive wherever you want, and really, you feel entitled to have not too many other people in your way. That would be a traffic jam, which none of us like. The interesting thing about that is that those gas taxes that we pay, state and federal, don't come close to covering the expenditures that governments lay out for building streets, roads, highways, bridges. So that's the biggest place that I've found in my research, that the cost to a driver of having a car and using it don't add up to paying the costs that governments incur to provide the infrastructure that allow you to drive.
Mm-hmm. And what you have suggested and argued for, and I'm sure that this is something that's going to, as soon as people hear it, they're going to be real unhappy, but what you have suggested is that essentially what are user fees for using the roads, things that are direct like tolls or the motor fuels taxes should be increased. And in fact, you're making the argument that really, if we were going to be more open and upfront about the way that we paid for our interstate highways, they ought to be toll roads.
Well, I do think that they should have been toll roads, and at this point it's clear that they need to be toll roads. We're in this situation now where everybody is feeling the pain of higher oil prices, which translates to higher gasoline prices, and the cost of filling up a tank of gas is higher. And it has gotten to the point where some people are starting to change their driving behavior. But Nevertheless, there is still the factor that our highways are crumbling. And how should those be fixed? How should our highways and bridges and infrastructure be fixed? Well, the way they were built originally 50 years ago, which is when the interstate system was initially built, they were built only half by gas taxes. And that was the first really high set of federal gas taxes. And many states raised their gas taxes in order to come up with their matching contributions that were required. But still, all those gas taxes in the 50s paid for only half the cost of the highway network. This is a highway network that is now crumbling. But 50 years ago when it was built, it was the largest public works project in human history, and arguably still is. So how are we supposed to pay for repairing that? Well, our current system, if all these user fees add up to only a third to a half, which is what my research indicates, of the actual costs of providing that infrastructure, the rest of it is coming from general revenues, from income taxes, from property taxes, from sales taxes, but mostly from income taxes, because a lot of this funding is federal and statewide. And the end result there, then, if you really think it through, is that people that drive less aren't paying less, and people that drive more are not paying more. The more you drive, the more of this government benefit you get to enjoy, and there's no reward for driving any less. We have incentives that encourage more driving and no reward for driving less, even though we have a problem with people driving too much, consuming too much oil, and wearing out the infrastructure. I'm not proposing a penalty system where, in many countries in the world, they rely on the gas taxes and tolls to raise revenue that they use for other purposes. I just think that to the extent that drivers use highways, they should pay the costs of the highways that they use. Now, there's a very legitimate complaint about this, which is that if you don't do this carefully, it can become a regressive tax. The idea that, I personally believe, and many Americans believe, although not all, that taxes are also supposed to be based on the ability to pay. That's why this proposal that I've come up with and been talking about recently tries to take into account, make it progressive by taking into account the cost of a car as a proxy for somebody's ability to pay. And what I've suggested is not only should we be putting tolls on more highways in order to ask the people that use the highways to bear the costs of them, but also we should do that in a way that takes into account a variety of other policy objectives, including making it progressive. We can do that by having cars registered in different categories, and those categories would be based on a combination of the expense of the car, the weight of the car, which directly relates to the wear and tear that it imposes on the highway, the emissions produced by that car, the emissions rating, and the gas mileage efficiency. Those last two are where we build into this system a disincentive for wasteful, inefficient consumer choices, and we build in rewards for efficient and environmentally sound decisions.
So that if you drive a Prius, your toll is less. If you drive an Escalade, your toll is more.
Exactly. The idea that a four-door luxury pickup truck that gets 12 miles to the gallon on a good day is charged the same toll as somebody who has way less money to spend and is trying to buy a much more efficient car that's producing fewer environmental externalities. That doesn't seem quite fair to me. In many, many ways, we have policy systems that are designed to encourage what we as a society decide are good choices and to discourage what we decide are bad choices. Obviously, any number of libertarians are going to be opposed to this proposal because it involves government deciding what's good or bad for people. But I don't think we can stick our head in the sand anymore on this. If you look at the environmental externalities of these decisions, there's the obvious ones of global warming and all the other complications that come from auto emissions. And there are also problems to take into account when you talk about the cost of an inefficient car. One of the arguments that I've heard people respond to my proposal with is, if I drive an inefficient car, I'm spending more at the gas pump, So there's a built-in penalty. I'm already paying a penalty for my wasteful choice. Why change? You know, why do we need to add to that? Well, the answer is you're paying that penalty, but there are additional penalties that everybody else is paying too for the inefficient choices. The way in which our need to secure an oil supply has affected our public policy, our international policy, our foreign policy, and our military policy is, I think, apparent to all Americans these days.
One more quick question, and I have callers I want to get to.
Sure.
We apparently won't know exactly about how much driving happened this past Memorial Day weekend for maybe until next week. But traditionally, it's been a weekend where people did do a lot of driving, and it appears that that fewer miles were driven this past weekend, and the obvious reason would be people are concerned about the high price of gas. So that may indeed we may indeed see the price of gasoline affecting people's interest in an inclination to drive. Do you think that something like this, if indeed the kind of user fees that were charged for driving were more in line with what the costs were, that that also would have a similar kind of effect, and in fact, there fewer miles would be driven?
Well, I think that that should be a policy objective. When I talked about those four aspects of people's lives, where they live, where they work, where they play, and where they shop, getting spread further and further away from each other over the last 50 years, and that's one of the reasons why people drive so much more than they used to. And I don't think we need to change this overnight, and it would be unfair and not good policy to try to make things so painful for people so quickly that they have to drastically change everything right away. But at the moment, we still have in place this archaic system where we have incentives for more driving. And if we can even just change it to neutral so that people have to pay their real costs, as we've just discussed, then yes, I think people will end up choosing to drive less. If it doesn't have that impact, then I would call it a failed policy, but I think it would. The problem is that the taxes need to be painful in order for people to avoid them.
All right.
So this is not something we can solve with a painless, invisible solution, because if it's painless and invisible, it won't change people's behaviors. And if we don't change people's behaviors, then we won't be solving the problem that we're in with crumbling infrastructure and environmental damage.
We have several callers, and we're at our midpoint here. Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Owen Goodfriend. He is Associate Professor of History and Urban Studies at Columbia University and is also Director of the Barnard and Columbia Urban Studies Programs, and has written quite a bit on these kinds of issues on urban history, suburbanization, sprawl, and transportation policy. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Lines are full here, so we'll get right to it, starting with Sycamore and line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, good morning. I'm really interested in the subject you're discussing, and I know that in Europe, taxes to support a lot of things are a lot higher than they are in this country. I understand the price of fuel is probably double what it is here. And I'm wondering if you've taken a look at how that has affected the way urban sprawl has developed in Europe.
This is something that I've done a lot of comparative work, not just with Europe, but with other countries around the world. I've looked at urbanization patterns in Australia, in Asia, in South America. Even in Canada is very different from the U.S. We often think of Canada as just like the U.S., but north of the border. But it's not really the case there. They also have much higher petrol taxes, as they call them in Canada, the gas taxes, and that affects many of these patterns. Sprawl, as we've experienced it in the U.S., the way we have disinvested from urban centers really since the 1960s and continue to have lots of real estate activity at the edges of metropolitan areas. This is a uniquely American problem, although it is cropping up in other parts of the world, but those are parts of the world that are trying to emulate the American way of life that they see in the media and in various other outlets. But there's no question that higher gas taxes does change these development patterns. But at the moment, what I'm focusing on not is some notion that cities are better and that suburbs are bad, but that We have a problem with insufficient flow of funds to maintain the highways we have, and we have environmental problems. I do happen to believe that incentives for higher density development in the long run will help us with these issues too, but that's a whole other layer separate from the transportation policy pieces.
Well, very good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank
you.
You're
welcome. Thank you for
your question. Let's go to someone else here. This is Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hi there. I had a couple things. One, wasn't there an attempt at a tax like this with Bill Clinton back 20 years ago or so? When they try and apply a 50% or 50-cent sales tax, gas tax, to try and raise money for alternative things? That was one question. And second thing is, I keep hearing about a documentary called "Who Killed the Electric Car." I've never seen it. I don't know about it, but it came up in a discussion when I was talking to my mechanic about how my Subaru used to get 45 miles a gallon, and I'd carry my family in it. And a smart car, which is, you know, about the size of a golf cart, it gets 45 miles a gallon. And the guy I talked to ahead of him was really proud of that. And I was like, well, that was 20 years ago that we got that. And so there's been some kind of backward movement and all those things, and I don't know what that's about. But the last thing was that is the weight of trucks and the huge amount of things that are shipped across the country. If those trucks were smaller and everybody drove slower, and then other people would be able to drive smaller cars and not be afraid of the big trucks, would that have any impact on the overall things that are going on? Thanks.
Well, you ask a number of very good questions, and I will try to answer all of them. There has been no realistic attempt to raise the gas tax by anything like 50 cents a gallon. There have been discussions of it. I think the last time that a presidential candidate discussed it on a scale that big, it was one of the many things about Ross Perot's campaign that did not resonate with most Americans. But there have been attempts to raise it. I think under the Clinton administration, they wanted to raise it by 10 cents a gallon, and they finally had to settle for 5 or 7 cents. I don't remember the exact details. But just to make it clear that this isn't necessarily a partisan issue, under the Reagan administration, there was also an attempt to raise gas taxes to pay for a greater share of the interstate highway system. That was a part of the shrinking federal government piece, was to raise gas taxes to raise the amount of money flowing into the Highway Trust Fund, so that the federal contribution to interstate highways didn't have to come straight off the federal budget, but would come straight through the Highway Trust Fund, which is one of these off-budget financing mechanisms. But just, I want to walk through the math on this, because it's amazing. We have all this fierce political debate of, no, 8 cents a gallon or 7 cents a gallon increase is too much, and we end up settling for increasing it by 5 cents a gallon. If you assume that somebody is driving many miles a year, 20,000 miles. That's above the national average, significantly above. Most Americans drive less than 20,000 miles a year. 20,000 miles a year. And say they have a moderately efficient car and they're getting 20 miles to the gallon, just for the simplicity of the math, that means they're buying 1,000 gallons a year. A 5 cents a gallon increase in the gas tax is a $50 increase. But it's greeted as though it's an assault on the national character.
Yeah.
And this is really an interesting issue. And this is one of the things that I really get into in detail in my book. I discovered that going back to the 1920s, you had this fascinating, very successful, very smart strategy on the part of a variety of corporate players, car manufacturers, cement makers, motel operators, oil companies, the gas station chains, tire manufacturers, that all got together and basically funded a multi-pronged, very carefully coordinated lobbying effort. They would show up in state capitals and in Congress and in county seats with experts. One expert would be from a group that was focused on highway safety, or would seem to be focused on highway safety, that would say, we need wider highways with bigger shoulders and gentler curves. And another group would say, would be testifying about the need to build new roads in order to stimulate the local economy. And then a third group would come and testify on behalf of car owners saying, but you can't raise the taxes on the owners because they're already paying as much as they can possibly afford, and it would be unfair. And what I discovered was that all these organizations had their offices in the same building in Washington and shared staff, and their overhead was underwritten by this group of companies that were literally invested in the success and continued growth of the American automobile industry. So that, I think, when this, you raise the question of who killed the electric car, there are all kinds of conspiracy theories out there, and I'm not a fan of conspiracy theories. The most popular conspiracy theory is one that's about killing mass transit, that a variety of automotive interests got together and bought up transit companies and shut them down across the United States. And in fact, actually, this is a subplot in the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which you wouldn't have thought is really about the car and sprawl, but if you go back and watch it, you'll see that this is mentioned repeatedly. But at any rate, this conspiracy theory that GM got together with a tire company and an oil company and bought these transit lines, well, it is actually a true story, but it's not the story that conspiracy theorists would like it to be, because they bought money-losing mass transit companies and shut them down because they were money-losing. So they didn't really take money from anybody, and they replaced these money-losing mass transit companies with bus companies using the same route franchises, and those bus companies ended up being profitable. The most interesting thing about that is that why the mass transit was money-losing and the bus companies were profitable, and that's because the bus companies got to use these generous government subsidies for highways, while the mass transit companies were stuck with franchise agreements that required them to put a cap on the fare that they could charge and contribute to the cost of maintaining the streets in a way that road users never needed to. I don't know if I answered all your questions, but I answered...
Well, in that documentary, what I've heard about it was that there was a thing where they had electric cars that were incredibly efficient, and then when California changed their laws back on emissions, that they crushed those cars and destroyed all of them. And that was kind of what I was told this was about. But what about the weight of trucks and the fact that we could reduce speed right now, and they say for every 5 miles, it's, what, 10%? If we had everybody drive at 60... And trucks weren't big, wouldn't that have a huge impact on the condition of our roads over time?
Well, this was one of the arguments when we went to 55 miles per hour in the 1970s for a national speed limit. The idea was that it was going to be more fuel efficient, which it is, and that it was going to reduce the wear and tear on the roads. But we seem to have been going in the other direction now. And the national speed limit there is no national speed limit. Many states have 65, but there's some states that have much higher speed limits. So I think that we could do some of those things, but they won't solve the bigger problems that we don't have enough money to maintain our existing roads and that we have a structure that encourages individuals to drive more and more each year. So there are so many things we can be doing, and you're suggesting some of them. What I would like to see is, even if policymakers across the country in state houses and in Congress start implementing some of the many possible solutions we might get somewhere. Mostly, though, people seem to be wanting to continue business as usual.
I want to thank the caller. We are moving into our last 15 minutes. We have some other folks, and I want to get on to others. And next is someone in Atlanta, Illinois, and that's line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Gentlemen, yeah. One of my more interesting things to listen to is discussions of transportation. And back to the previous caller, and the question hasn't exactly been answered, is the truck issue and the fact that I heard and have witnessed what damage trucks do relative to even Escalades as far as the road. I've heard the trucks, one truck can do 1,000 times more damage than a regular sized car. So, you know, trucks really are getting a free pass as far as using the infrastructure. And there's obviously something that hasn't been up here is alternatives. Yes, we need to have higher taxes. I agree with all this whole argument on the taxes. But the one thing we do is to need to get lots of vehicles off the interstates, particularly the interstates, and, you know, then they're going to be easier to maintain. And we need to start investing money back into railroads, not only for a lot of the freight that's on trucks, but also passenger service. With computerization, we ought to be able to run our railroads at least equal to what we did in World War II, which hauled massive amounts of relative freight and passengers comparatively what it could do today. And so those issues haven't been discussed. So back to the trucks thing, and the 1,000 times each more damage a truck does than a car, and railroads.
Thank you for bringing us back to that. I think it's a very good point, but there's two sides to it also. On the one hand, there's no question that when I talk about raising money for transportation infrastructure, I'm not only talking about repairing and maintaining the roads that we have, but I think we need to invest a lot more money in our rail networks. An earlier caller asked about the comparisons between European cities and American cities and development patterns. I think one of the biggest striking contrasts in many other parts of the world compared to the U.S. is that there are good, well-funded, affordable train networks where people who have a choice will choose to take the train. Whereas most of the time in the United States, if you have a choice, you choose to drive, whether versus mass transit. The only reason why people choose mass transit as opposed to cars has to do with traffic. And so that's a negative for the car choice. Rarely are people choosing the mass transit options because it's safe, efficient, comfortable, and convenient. And we need to fix that. So I fully agree with that. But going back to the truck issue, one of the complications with this, yes, there is way more wear and tear from a truck. And I don't know whether it's, 200 times or 1,000 times or 900 times. I've heard all kinds of numbers. It's much higher. Truckers do pay much higher tolls, arguably not enough higher, but they do pay much higher tolls. Perhaps that needs to be increased. But one of the complications here is that we can change the way we live our individual lives gradually over time so that the four functions of our life are not as dispersed and we need to drive less. But we do need, economically, to be able to get goods all around the country. And there's always going to be a need for a lot of trucking. Possibly there's a lot of substitution we could be doing now from truck to rail. But that doesn't mean we can get trucks off of the interstates. We could possibly have less of them. But we can't get them off the interstates. So the interstates will still need to be built with the pavement thicknesses and the lane widths and all the tolerances that are required to be safe for trucks. That's one of the things that makes it expensive. So I think this is something we can make some incremental changes in, but trucks can't be viewed entirely as the villain because our economy really is dependent on getting goods around the country in places that rail networks don't and won't ever go.
Well, that's exactly right. But we need to start working on cutting back unnecessary truck traffic as well as passenger car traffic. And I'm glad that you're in agreement on the railroads because there's quite, when a train trip costs one-tenth the fuel per person that a car does on an average, what I heard on this very station just a couple weeks ago, that's a tremendous savings. And actually, if the advertising was done right and everything, train travel is much more pleasant than having to steer a stupid car down the interstate.
Well, I agree in many, many ways. And one of the interesting things there, the historian in me wants to point out that there's a reason why Americans look askance at trains and subways and commuter rail compared to the car. Aside from the cultural notion of the open road and the feelings of freedom and autonomy that you get from your own car, which is powerfully central to a lot of American cultural values, there's also this problem that in the 19th century, the railroads and the mass transit systems were privately owned by people that were making their millions at the expense of working people. And we associated the railroads, initially we associated them with the robber barons. There were the railroad tycoons and oil tycoons and steel manufacturers were the villains in 19th century industrial America. And then after that, you had this problem where the mass transit companies, including some commuter rail companies, had their fares capped by mandate, by their contracts with government entities. But after World War I, inflation was rising, costs were going up much faster than their fares were allowed to go up, and they ended up having to disinvest, and they were providing by the early 20th century bad service and unreliable service and uncomfortable service. So we have these two associations with rail and mass transit of there's an inconsistency there, but they're still built into our notions that somehow it was poor service, it was run down, and also somebody's making money at our expense. And those things are carryovers. As a practical matter, it's always interesting to me when you hear proposals for investments in rail. You'll have policymakers do an analysis, people talking about when will it pay for itself. There's discussion about the new subway system, for example, in Los Angeles, and people are wondering when it's ever going to pay for itself. Nobody ever asks when a highway is going to pay for itself.
I want to thank the last caller again and get on to some others and just very quickly introduce again our guest, Owen Goodfriend. He is Associate Professor of History and Urban Studies at Columbia University, also Director of the Barnard and Columbia Urban Studies Programs, and among other things in his research is interested in urban history and suburbanization and sprawl and transportation policy. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is over in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4 right here. Hello.
Hello. The last caller has got to some of my points. I wanted to ask the question, often people who are trying to kill Amtrak will have some figure that the federal subsidy for going from, Chicago to Los Angeles, or they pick random places, is so many hundreds of dollars. And I wondered if you had either purposefully or accidentally ever done any comparison, it would be possible to tell the federal subsidy for driving your car from one of those points to another. It's just coming off of the various things that you've made.
That's finding
the show fascinating.
That's a great question, and I have not done that kind of individual trip study. I've been looking systems-wide. I look at going back 50 years, but right through the end of the 20th century, I've been looking at state and national transportation budgets and how much of those budgets are covered by the aggregated user fees and how much of those budgets are covered from more general revenues. And in that study, what I've seen is that the typical number is about one-third of the transportation costs are covered by contributions directly from the users of the transportation system. But I have not looked at how you translate that subsidy into individual trips.
One-third the cost of any system or of the mass transit systems?
No, this is of the highway infrastructure.
Of highways.
Highway infrastructure.
That's behind a lot of buses.
As a practical matter, we expect mass transit systems to pay for themselves culturally, and I think that's one of our problems that we need to get past in order to solve the problems. You know, the premise of this whole discussion is, can we have effective transportation policy that's also environmentally sound? And the answer to that is that we can only do that if we're willing to change the way we approach this problem. And one of those changes needs to be, we need to stop thinking of mass transit as needing to be self-sufficient, and we complain about subsidies to mass transit, like Amtrak that you brought up, at the same time that we don't expect our highway infrastructure to be self-sustaining, and we, in fact, in general, Americans want more subsidy for highways and less subsidy for mass transit, and that's only perpetuating the problem and making it worse.
Yes, and by the way, I think that your global analysis is probably much more sensible than the per-trip analysis that I was talking about. I just want to comment also, part of the different attitude may be in the 19th century when all those transit concessions and so on were first devised.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if your research goes back that far. I should say I'm also a historian and I've done research on this in the 19th century in Latin America. But it seems like all over the world they were trying to make money. The cities are trying to make money off the concessions. And by the time we build the highways, the notion of what government should do has moved on to where they're willing to lose money on things. And so we're still sort of stuck with this concession model on the mass transit stuff.
Well, it's funny. You raise a very good question. And it certainly the models have changed, but that varies by which country you look at. One of the countries that I studied a lot because it is similar but different to the United States is Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And in their situation, they end up with cities with very robust, very well-developed mass transit systems, But that's partially because the government owned the suburban land, and they were using expansions of mass transit as a means of capturing the value of undeveloped land. So they very carefully made sure to develop mass transit lines out into their land.
Wow.
And that's one. So it's a very local circumstance that affects each of these situations. The one overall pattern that I've discerned in studying, as I mentioned earlier, in Australia, in South America, and in Asia, and these are 20th century studies, not 19th century, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
What I've clearly observed, though, is that there are no countries you can find that have the same really very, very, very strong subsidies for automotive transportation at the same time that there's a reluctance to subsidize mass transit. And the result is that there are no countries that have the same kind of land use patterns that the United States has, where we abandon city centers at the same time that we build at the edge.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Champaign County next. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I struck a nerve earlier when you talked about taxes as penalties, and I use the user fee analogy a lot, and it's like you can say that trucks and the companies that ship things on trucks should be more responsible to the common weal, but it isn't a penalty. Like congestion fee, if implemented in New York City, would not be a penalty. It would be a reflection on, you know, the incredible amount. I mean, you could do a user fee analysis and look at all of the subsidy that's gone into creating that infrastructure and say people need to throw in and if they're going to bring their car in. So I just object to that theoretically, though user fee is useful, it seems to me. But I wanted to throw a more specific thing, and I guess it's a little parochial because it has to do with a lot of activism here and mayors in both of these towns in the city where, and the university system was quite seriously looking into a tram, a light rail system for the most congested part of the downtowns and the campus that lies between them. But it was so shot down, so lampooned. I mean, they went to Europe, they looked at similar size cities and found that there was, you know, you can even make an economic development argument for that kind of system, changing the patterns and things. But, you know, the representative, Tim Johnson, from this district gets votes for CAFE standards. He gets a pass from his leadership to vote for CAFE standards and gets an award from a local environmental group, but then, you know, he is one of the most adamantly opposed to any kind of subsidy for a tram system, even if it makes good economic sense. It's just so I wanted to spout, and I know there's very little time, but if you could treat both of those subjects, I'd appreciate it.
I will. In our remaining time, I'll try to address both of those. First of all, I agree with your notion that we're really talking about user fees more than taxes, and I thought I was making the distinction that we would in no instance under this proposal that I'm trying to advance should we be raising user fees to the point that they penalize people. But we need to stop keeping user fees so low that they reward choices that we think are not desirable choices. And we should at least get to a decision-neutral set of user fees, which is stopping short of user fees that are high enough that they provide a disincentive. Disincentive and penalty are I think, that's just there's embedded values, but they mean the same thing. Your example, the congestion fees that were proposed and defeated in New York, I think is a very interesting one. One of the things that people don't realize in terms of user fees, I'm talking about user fees that actually bring revenue into the system that then provides infrastructure, but people were paying, are continuing to pay a congestion charge every time they drive in New York. That is a charge on their time. And time is worth money, although Americans famously are known for undervaluing their own time. But it's not at all clear that if people paid a congestion charge to drive into Lower Manhattan, that they would come out poorer at the end of the day. Because if the goal of that was to discourage people who had choices and could choose not to drive into the city from doing so, then there would be less traffic in the city, and the congestion charge you pay a $8 to get into the city, and then while you're in the city, there's less traffic, you're able to be more efficient, you accomplish more of the economic activity you needed to accomplish in less time, and you're rewarded for in a way that exceeds the $8. The highway example of that, it goes back to, say, the Pennsylvania Turnpike when it was built. There were people saying, you shouldn't charge a toll. Even then, there was a very organized, this is the 1930s, very organized lobby against toll roads. And they were arguing, no, you should not charge tolls. We should build this road that spans the state, but we should not charge tolls on it because it will benefit people in so many great ways that we should build it and have it be toll-free. And that did not succeed there. It was tolled. And the result, though, is that there were interviews with truckers that were using it from one end to the other saying, it cost me $37 to go from one end of the state to the other on this toll road, but it saved me $210 in time and repair costs on average per trip because I don't have to stop and start as much, the road is in better condition, and it takes way less time. So there are all these different factors that go into this.
Yeah, I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to you, okay. My apologies to the caller, but we're simply at the point where we're going to have to stop,
and
we're out of time. We've touched on a lot of really interesting areas. Perhaps we can find some ways to talk about them again on other shows. I'm sure we will, but for right now, we're going to have to stop because we're just right at the end of the hour. And just, Professor Goodfriend, I want to say to you, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Well, I thank you for having me on the show.
Our guest is Owen Goodfriend. He is Associate Professor of History and Urban Studies at Columbia University. He is also Director of the Barnard and Columbia Urban Studies Programs. You might be interested in looking at his book, 20th Century Sprawl, Highways and the Reshaping of the American Landscape, published by the Oxford University Press.